You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
Scopes?
Oh, please, after you.
No, after you.
Scopes Monkey Choir. The podcast where music and sound meet science and skepticism.
Episode 51.
My name is Matt.
I'm Hai Ting.
And this is pretty much our 1 year anniversary doing this podcast.
1 year of Scopes Monkey Choir.
Yeah, we missed 1 week, so this is so whatever the hell that means.
I'm tired. Let's stop. Stop.
Okay, wait. Don't turn off your
MP3 player is not malfunctioning.
It's part of the thing.
I'm tired. You guys may
be familiar with this effect from Radiolab. Which
this effect discovered by Diana Deutsch.
Yes, where you start to hear a melody in a repeating speech phrase, because of course there is pitch in there, and in this one you can hear that little arpeggio. I'm tired, let's stop.
Like that.
It's an octave up, and the operatic version.
I'm tired, let's stop. So was this a setup for later? Well, how does this work?
Yeah, because what we're going to talk about today is priming, and also pareidolia, which is a similar related phenomenon.
Wait, let's sing along with it.
I'm tired, let's stop.
I don't mean you.
And if you haven't stopped listening yet, you will never again be able to hear that bit of recording without hearing the little melody in it. And that is part of priming that we're going to be talking about today.
Yes.
So priming or pareidolia or both?
Well, we have the news to do first.
The news to do first after all that?
I know. I'm a bastard, aren't I?
All right.
You want to do? We can do the news at the top of the next thing, because we're doing two episodes today.
So, yeah, tell us the news.
Okay. Well, it's just one little thing, because I had to talk about it, because it has to do with heavy metal music and suicide. Everyone's favorite topic. All right. Now, as you know, like, I'm always looking at like music science news and stuff and keeping track of articles, and I came across and one of the things you see a fair amount is this ongoing thing of parents being afraid of heavy metal music, and we've talked about it before. And but I found this slightly interesting, because there's this this Australian researcher. There was this article about her research that basically said that she has found that there's a link between listening to heavy metal and suicide. And it has, like, she all these,
well,
like,
that's what the reporting said.
Right, that's what the reporting said. But they took all these quotes of hers, and they made it sound like, I mean, she says things like, you know, most people listen to a range of music in positive ways, to block out crowds, to lift their mood, or give them energy when exercising. Which already is like, okay, blocking out crowds, that's a positive way. Anyway, but young people at risk of depression are more likely to be listening to music, particularly heavy metal music, in a negative way. So she's making this distinction between listening positively and listening negatively. And
what?
It's just like, yeah, exactly. And then she goes and says all this stuff. Now, like I say, this kind of thing comes up and we tend to ignore it because it just gets so tiring. But this was sort of interesting because it got picked up by metalinsider.net. They wrote about it and complained about it, and then some of their regular readers actually pointed out that actually, you know, in the article some of it's probably out of context, and her research doesn't seem to actually be that when you try to, you know, look at her actual papers and stuff. And then on top of that, I should probably give her a name.
She's in Australia, right?
Yeah, Dr. McFerrin. No relation, I assume. She actually got in touch with metalinsider.net metalinsider.net. And
Metal Insider sounds like people with hip replacements.
Or a robot fan site, yeah, maybe. Well,
that's a metal outsider.
A metal all-arounder.
What? Wow, sorry.
So she actually responded because she, you know, recognized that she was being misunderstood. And I'm just going to read a little bit of what she said. She said, "Music is important, but it's not magic. It can't control your mind, although I think it can make a difference in your life. So why did so many people think that my study was saying metal music causes mental illness? It totally doesn't. Music is not that powerful, and nor do all people who like metal music suffer from depression, although some do." So I just thought all this was interesting because she actually sort of got involved, and then the metal
the way she got involved,
backed off and said,
"What you're saying is that she actually read the comments on the websites where her reporting was."
Yeah. There's a little noise gift from our cat.
Our house is falling down around us.
Yeah.
So she actually read all those.
Yeah, and she recognizes that there's a media bias about these things. She actually, there's another quote, "In contrast to simplistic, to the simplistic public interpretations of these findings, researchers have often suggested that certain musical preferences are suggestive of vulnerability to mental health problems." And the distinction she's trying to make is that, her research currently is trying to figure out if some people listening to certain kinds of music actually makes them more depressed, as opposed to most people report that when they listen to music they like, it cheers them up in some form or another.
Even if it's sad music?
Even if it's sad music, exactly.
So like usually the wallowing in your misery with your music
actually
you feel better.
Kind of makes you feel better.
Or it makes you report that you're feeling
so
better.
So what she's researching is people who listen to music who, it's the music that they say they like, but it doesn't seem to make them feel better.
Or at least they
and
report
what does that mean?
They don't feel better.
Right, exactly.
Because these are all from
self-reporting. Yeah. But she's just trying to figure out, like, is that a warning sign, is what she's trying to figure out, which is perfectly reasonable, because warning signs are good to find out because teenagers do commit suicide, and that's bad.
Yeah. I mean, I barely remember being a teenager, but I got to say, I did not listen to heavy metal music. But when I was depressed and I listened to songs that seemed to sort of go with my depression, I never felt like I felt better. I felt like I felt...
Well, you know,
so much worse, but
just felt bad,
like,
all the time.
Felt like it magnified it.
You were a nerd, though, I think.
Hey,
hey, that's the little.
I'm tired. Let's stop. I'm tired. Let's stop.
Are we gonna play that again?
I'm tired. No, I'm just telling you. Shall we move on to our main topic?
Okay.
Priming, pareidolia.
Priming and pareidolia.
Pattern recognition.
Apophenia. Let's start there, because apophenia, pareidolia, a lot of skeptics know that word, which I will define in a second. But first we have apophenia, which is the perception of connections and meaningfulness of unrelated phenomena, basically seeing patterns where there ain't none. And then there's a subcategory of that, which is pareidolia. Did we say pareidolia before? Because I pronounce it wrong all the time. Pareidolia.
Pareidolia is right?
Yeah, I think so.
Right?
Well, it's got an O.
Right?
Yeah. Pareidolia is the is a vague or obscure stimulus being perceived as something clear and distinct. And just so you know, both that definition and the apophenia one are both from the Skeptics Dictionary, which is a great resource, skeptic.com.
So apophenia is seeing pattern in randomness.
Mm.
So like if I said...
And, I can't believe you. That is an insult.
And you heard Scopes Monkey Choir is the best podcast in the universe. Uh-huh. That would be apophenia or pareidolia?
Well, I would think of that as pareidolia, because pareidolia is like something a little, seeing something more specific.
Apophenia is perceiving any kind of pattern in randomness.
Apophenia,
and our brains are basically made to do this.
Right. It's all about pattern recognition. And apophenia refers, it's like the umbrella above pareidolia. Apophenia
pareidolia.
Can refer pareidolia. Ah, thank
P-A-R-E-I-D-O-L-I-A.
You.
P-A-R-E-I-D-O-L-I-A for all you nerds trying to Google it.
Oh,
because it took
all the
me
nerds
so
who listen
long.
To this know how to spell it.
No, it took me so long to figure out how to spell it right. Fortunately,
so
Google knew.
Apophenia is the umbrella. And so, for instance, apophenia can refer to the way that conspiracy theorists work. It can refer to... I can't think of any other skeptical examples at the moment. But
pareidolia is seeing something, seeing or hearing or perceiving something specific that actually is not there.
Right.
Like, exactly. The classic example is clouds. Like, you look up in the sky and you say, oh, it's a bunny. Oh, no, it's a dinosaur. Oh, no, it's a dinosaur eating a bunny. That's right. All pareidolia. It's not, there aren't actually dinosaurs eating bunnies in the clouds. I hope.
No, there was at one time. Let's move back a little bit to go back to just talking about speech. And because since we're doing the pareidolia, everyone knows the visual stuff mainly, but there's a lot of audio pareidolia as well. And a lot of it has to do with hearing words where there aren't words or hearing the incorrect words.
Let me just finish a little bit about pareidolia for those who don't really know about it. You were talking about how most pareidolia is visual, and the biggest, most popular things are like seeing the Virgin Mary on your toast. Right. Or Jesus on a taco.
But everyone knows, they all know about pareidolia.
Well, I don't
right?
know that everybody who listens to this podcast nah. knows that all of that is pareidolia, or like seeing the faces on the moon, or basically like faces are the biggest one, one that our brains are most ready to recognize.
Because we have a whole part of our brain which is specifically for recognizing faces.
An entire part of our brain that's specifically for recognizing faces. Exactly. That's why we see them in rocks and tacos mm-hmm. and
dog
tacos
butts.
And rocks and dog butts. Yes.
The Jesus dog
butt
is my
favorite. That's a
really
good
one.
Now you're going to have to put that on our website.
Yeah.
So anyway, the recognition of faces like that seems to be a really, really deep-seated brain function that starts when we're babies. Is basically like an automatic function of our brains. And as you were saying, most audio pareidolia has to do with language. We hear language where there is no language, or there is not the full capacity, the full every single sound of language.
Mm.
And a lot of times that's maybe not quite as primal a function of our brains, because language is spread out across our brains and we sort of put together meaning from all different sections of our brains that are hearing intonation and phonemes and context, and all these things go together to create understanding of language. So why don't you play that example of not quite speech?
Okay, yeah, this is a not quite speech example, and it's also not quite pareidolia.
No, it's not.
But we'll talk about that when we in a minute. So here's the first part. All right, that probably doesn't sound like anything to you.
But it might sound a little speech-like?
Yeah, it sounds a little speech-like. But now what happens if you hear what it's, quote, supposed to be saying, unquote?
The man read the newspaper at lunchtime.
Okay, now here's the first one again. Ma? Eh?
So basically what's happening in this case is you get this pattern that is a pattern. It's a deliberate pattern. It's the pitch pattern of that British speech, not of an American saying the man read the newspaper at lunchtime.
Right.
But it's all the pitch information from the British phrase, the man read the newspaper at lunchtime. And then the effect is called priming. That you hear the phrase, and then when you hear the pitch information, you insert the...
when you're given the pitch information in the form of the woman actually speaking.
Yeah, your brain connects up those two things, and the priming effect works to make you hear the words in the pattern that has no consonants or vowels in it.
Right. So basically you're being taught, your brain is like, okay, wait, I see there are patterns there, but I can't, it doesn't quite make sense, but your brain is just automatically trying to make sense of it. It doesn't quite make sense. And then when you're given the key, which is the woman speaking, then your brain's like, got it. And then the next time you hear it, it sounds like it.
Yeah. So this word that we're using, priming, in psychology, it's basically...
Wait, is it used differently? Do skeptics use it differently than it's used in psychology?
Well, it's been changed over the past 10 or 20 years. It used to be basically the idea that experience with a certain stimulus in the past will help you to recognize that stimulus in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds basically like learning something makes learning how to recognize something makes you recognize it.
Right.
But it's very deep-seated. They've done work with deeply amnesiac people who have no conscious memory and who can't seem to learn anything new. But they can nonetheless improve things with priming. They can improve their recognition of things. They can improve their, they can do tasks better. Basically, they can still learn in some part of their brain can still learn.
Mm.
And it's some deep-seated visceral part that you don't necessarily have conscious access to. So priming maybe 10, 15 years ago was basically studied by exposing somebody to a certain stimulus, whether it was a word or a picture or any kind of sensory stimulus, and then later having them look at that stimulus or a piece of it again.
Mm-hmm.
And they were much faster to recognize the same thing that they had seen, even if they had forgotten seeing it. Or say,
I see. Okay, so,
it was never done. These experiments were never done. That was really vague. Let me give you an example. Okay, so people read a list of words,
mm-hmm.
and then later they heard another list of words with a lot of background noise, so that the words were barely recognizable,
mm-hmm.
and they were much more able to recognize the words that they had already heard than the familiar words that were in there, but they had not heard.
Interesting.
3 hours
earlier.
Then,
so the words that they'd heard initially, it was the same recording, so same tonal information
it
of the word.
It did not say that in the literature.
Uh-huh.
It's sort of implied, though, don't you think? Not necessarily.
Okay.
I think that they maybe did those reading the words live. But in any case, the idea is that they thought that being given the same piece of information in the same sensory mode, so either that was the auditory experiment, and the visual ones were things like people would read a list of words, and then a few hours later they would be asked to complete words from the first couple of letters, and they were much more likely to fill in quickly words that they had read a couple of hours before.
Mm.
Even mm-hmm. if they were just given an initial letter, they were more likely to fill out the word that they had seen.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was that they were primed to do something in particular more easily because they had been exposed to it previously.
Yeah. Now, can I ask you an anecdotal question? Which is that when one of the few scientific experiments I ever took part in was when I was an undergraduate. I was drafted. No, wait. What's the word? Hooked by a hook into a laboratory.
Conned.
I was brought in on an experiment, and I was brought into this room with a bunch of other undergraduates. There was a TV video.
Oh, paid. You were paid.
I don't remember being paid. If I was paid,
weren't they supposed to pay
probably
for
in
that
Twinkies
stuff?
And, or something. Hmm. I don't remember. But there was a TV screen, and one of the researchers basically said to us, okay, you're about to watch a video of a woman talking, and then you're going to answer some questions on the questionnaire in front of you, and that's it. Okay, thanks. Left the room. We watched the video of a woman talking, and then we answered the questions. Now, it was very strange. The video was very strange. It was a little fuzzy, and you didn't get quite a sense of the person too well, but you could understand what she was saying and everything, and blah blah blah. What it turned out after the study was done, and I went and talked to one of the researchers, what it actually was is that our group said you're about to see a video of a woman speaking, and then there was another group where they said you're about to see a video of a man speaking, and then there was a control group where they said you're about to see a video of someone speaking, and then all the questions asked about the person speaking and everything, but they had these sort of hot button terms in them and such. And the idea was, I can't remember the details well enough to explain the results or anything. But my question is, they were studying the perceptions of men
gender,
and of gender perception, right? Exactly. So my question is for you: is that priming when they
tell one group one thing,
another group another thing, and then
yes.
a control? Okay.
Now I was going to say that that originally priming was just experimented with within the same perception, like sight for sight and audio for audio, touch uh-huh. for touch. And they thought that it only worked that way. And this was only 10 or 15 years ago, I think. Between that time, they started doing priming experiments cross-sensory. And then priming experiments like you were talking about, mm-hmm. Although I believe that would have been more than 10 years ago.
Yes, but I don't know if they called it priming.
I don't know if they called it priming, but I believe they do now. And now they're doing experiments like one that was reported in the New York Times a couple of years ago, where they had people play a sort of stock exchange game, a sort of competitive money game of some kind in a room where there was either a briefcase or a backpack just randomly sitting there at the other end of a table from them, and the people who were in a room with a briefcase played much more competitively than people who were in a room with a backpack.
Wow.
And then there was another one where they they fed people cookies in a room where there either was or was not the smell of cleaning fluid. Yeah. And those who were in a room with the smell of cleaning solution cleaned up their crumbs three times more often than people who were not. So they're calling this priming too. And at this point, we recognize that our subconscious influences our subconscious influences our actions in ways that we are not even aware of.
Right.
So I don't know where that all leads us for pareidolia, but I think that if you're in a certain situation where you're primed emotionally to see a certain kind of pattern, then you're probably much more likely to see it or hear it.
Indeed.
Or smell it or taste it
or maybe balance it or whatever. There are 11 senses now. Can we play that other cool voice thing?
Okay.
Wait. Hey, listen to this one.
Tune in next week to find out what that was and how the hell we're going to relate it to what we were just talking about.
Oh, we're so mean.
Or how badly we fail.
We're not going to say what that was? Okay.
Thank you for listening to Scopes Monkey Choir.
From ScopesMonkeyChoir.com.
We are professional musicians, but not scientists.
If you doubt something we've said, don't believe us. Look it up yourself.
I have lost my outro. You better finish it.
Each episode's page at ScopesMonkeyChoir.com has references and citations. We welcome your feedback. Write to ScopesMonkeyChoir@gmail.com.
Gmail.com.
Or call the monkey phone and leave a message. 347-788-0330.
Oh, I tweet at ScopesMonkeys. I know that bit.
I tweet at SquidOcto. I also blog at HoorayReality.com.
Hooray Reality.
Bye.
Thanks for listening.
Part two next week.